Hello. We're planning a Lincoln Douglas style debate. We're going to start out with the question presented is going to be: there should be no legal duty to moderate. There should be no legal duty for the operator of a public online forum to moderate its content. Arguing in the affirmative, we have Mr. Scioli. Arguing in the negative is going to be Professor White. I'm going to keep time, and I will let the speakers know when their time is up, and we'll move on to the next phase. So with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Scioli to argue the affirmative construction.
Good evening, everyone. Before I begin, I'd like to thank the Student Legal Forum for inviting me to be here tonight and for the great hospitality so many of you have shown me this weekend. I'd especially like to thank Andrew and Troy for the immense work they have put into organizing this event over the past few months. As you know, the topic of tonight's debate is whether there should be a legal duty for the operator of an online forum to moderate its content. Why does this matter? Why do we even care? Because it's the essence of freedom on the internet. It's about the ability to publish anonymous speech without forcing website owners to claim legal responsibility. This is about preventing the Great Firewall of China from coming here to the United States. It's about allowing new ideas to flow freely. However, I recognize not all of you are familiar with this area of the law. Accordingly, while it may put me at a disadvantage time-wise, I think it's important to place this narrow issue that is the subject of this debate in its broader context. Under the common law, an individual entity is not just liable for defamatory statements as author itself. Rather, common law rules evolve to allow one to be held vicariously liable for the defamatory statements of others under certain circumstances. These vicarious liability standards have historically been determined based on perceptions regarding an individual or firm's level of control over the communications medium that transmits or contains those defamatory statements. Prior to the advent of the internet, the common law generally assessed vicarious liability for third-party defamatory speech based on whether the entity fell into one of three groups. Generally, those who own and operate print and broadcast media outlets, such as newspapers and television stations, are publishers and, accordingly, subject to publisher liability. An entity subject to liability as a publisher may be found liable for defamation without regard for whether it is the original author of the statement, or even if it had foreknowledge of its defamatory nature. For one who repeats or otherwise republishes defamatory matter is subject to liability as if he had originally authored it. Why did the common law evolve in a way that held print and broadcast media owners liable for repeating defamatory statements of third parties? Traditionally, newspapers, book publishers, and broadcasters possess a significant amount of editorial control and discretion over their content, and frequently devoted an immense amount of time and expense to vet stories for publication or broadcast, which often conveys a sense of authoritativeness to readers or viewers. Consistent with this perception of the print and broadcast media, courts treat these publishers as having adopted the defamatory statements as their own. However, distributors, unlike publishers, are considered passive conduits of information. Thus, an individual, such as a bookstore or newsstand owner, who only delivers or transmits defamatory matter published by a third person, is subject to liability if, but only if, he knew or had reason to know if it's a defamatory character and chose to distribute it anyway. Thus, passive conduits who still maintain some control over the dissemination of information after publication, such as through the decision to sell or not sell the defamatory book, still face liability under the common law if they choose to continue to disseminate defamatory information after being made aware of the defamatory content. In contrast, common carriers, like telephone and telegraph companies, have traditionally been immunized from liability for defamatory statements relayed over their networks. Since common carriers have no control over the statements transmitted over the networks, and since they are required by law to serve all customers, courts have generally held that they are not liable for these defamatory statements. Now, the internet does not fit neatly into these three vicarious liability categories established by the common law. Like newspapers and other publishers, internet forums and intermediaries appear to have the ability to pre-screen third-party content, even if they choose not to do so. But unlike publishing a newspaper or broadcasting a television show, both of which inherently require significant financial resources and a non-trivial time commitment, the monetary and time costs of publishing online are virtually non-existent. Internet intermediaries, like bookstore owners, are also usually in a position to remove content after they have received notice that is defamatory. However, unlike these distributors, many internet intermediaries allow their users to access literally billions of pages of content, with millions of new web pages, message board posts, Usenet postings, emails, and other user-generated content being created every day. But while granting such access resembles the function of a common carrier, unlike common carriers, internet intermediaries can, and often do, terminate or refuse service, and have no legal obligation to accept all transmissions. Not surprisingly, the first courts to consider this issue did not speak with a unified voice. Notably, while a Southern District of New York judge held that CompuServe was not liable as a publisher for third-party content, a New York State trial court found that Prodigy was liable for postings by subscribers on its message boards because Prodigy, by actively deleting some offensive posts but not others, had assumed the role of a publisher. Congress, fearing the impact the Prodigy decision would have on internet intermediary behavior, took immediate action to clarify the legal standard that courts should apply to internet intermediaries sued for torts committed by their users or other third parties. In codifying 47 U.S.C. 230, or Section 230 for short, Congress declared that, quote, no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider, end quote, and also enacted a Good Samaritan provision to clarify that an intermediary cannot be deemed to have waived this immunity simply by choosing to moderate or control user-generated content. To further this purpose, Congress also preempted all contrary state law and essentially created a uniform national standard. Since Section 230's enactment in 1996, numerous federal and state appellate courts have interpreted the statute and consistently rejected both direct and indirect attempts by plaintiffs to limit the scope of the immunity. Because of the time constraints imposed on me, I do not have the time to discuss any specific cases, but it's fair to say that courts have universally ruled that internet intermediaries, including message boards, do not have a legal duty to moderate third-party content. Fortunately, having established this context, I do not think I have much time left to delve into the heart of the matter at this moment. However, over the course of tonight's proceedings, I hope to make three main points in support of Section 230. First, Section 230 immunizes intermediaries from vicarious liability, but not direct liability. That means that whoever authored the defamatory statement, whether it's a user or the intermediary itself, is not immune and may be held directly liable as a principal. Accordingly, Section 230 does not leave defamation victims without a remedy, but instead encourages victims to hold the actual bad guy responsible, rather than use the legal system as a tool for seeking vengeance against an innocent party or to recover from a deep pocket. Moreover, Section 230 encourages defamation victims to seek out private remedies which they may not have otherwise considered, and which may provide a more effective remedy than the blunt force of a lawsuit. Second, Section 230 is necessary to facilitate an open and free marketplace of ideas on the internet. Section 230, as a uniform standard, allows intermediaries to clearly and unambiguously know that, regardless of jurisdiction or the facts of any particular case, that they will be shielded from liability for statements which they did not author. This not only eliminates the use of a heckler's veto to stifle a protected speech, but allows message board owners and other intermediaries to exercise their own discretion to delete content without having liability concerns dictate their decision. And finally, even if Section 230 results in some hurt feelings, this is an appropriate trade-off for a robust and vibrant internet. Speech is a network good, which means that it is more valuable when more people use it. More valuable for building communities, for igniting illuminating debates, and for spreading ideas. In this respect, even incorrect speech has value, for the search for truth and citizens transcending their differences in order to forge consensus on issues of public concern are key functions of a free and uninhibited marketplace of ideas. Because several remedies already exist for defamation victims to seek redress besides suing an immunized intermediary, while no remedy exists for the damage a chilling effect does to the marketplace of ideas, as a matter of policy, it is preferable to err on the side of subsidizing speech. Thank you.
Nice to see some of you again. Let me start off by asking whether the picture that you've painted of the internet changes if most of the participants for particular websites are anonymous.
I don't think it changes the nature of it at all, and in fact I believe that anonymous participation will enhance the marketplace of ideas by allowing individuals who might otherwise be afraid to come forward with their stories to go and let other people know of what's going on, essentially act as whistleblowers.
But I thought you said that one of the purposes of Section 230 is to encourage private lawsuits. How can people sue anonymous posters, and therefore, if most posters on certain websites, auto admit being one, are anonymous, then I would think that 230, by immunizing, ought to admit in its entirety, actually has the opposite effect.
I disagree. As I mentioned in my initial introduction, there are other remedies available, the most obvious remedy being a John Doe lawsuit brought against the individual speakers of the defamatory statement, which was exactly what happened in the auto-admit case, and apparently with some success.
Well, let's consider what the effect of the John Doe lawsuit is. Suppose the concern of the individual is with privacy or reputation. How is a John Doe lawsuit going to facilitate redress when the effect of a John Doe lawsuit is going to be to identify the person in question?
I guess the question is, what sort of redress do you expect the victims to obtain by suing the intermediary, who in many cases has not done anything wrong? Are these victims seeking monetary damages? Are you seeking to clear a name? Are you seeking vindication? And that really depends. You need to figure out what the goal of the plaintiff is, and then that will help fashion the appropriate remedy.
All right, let's turn to the question of whether the intermediaries have actually done nothing wrong. You said earlier that the operators of websites have capacity to use discretion to delete postings from the website. That assumes that they're being aware of the content of the postings. So if a posting that is particularly singles out an individual and makes comments, derogatory comments about that individual that might otherwise be tortious in a print regime, shouldn't the operator of the website be on notice that that's troublesome to that individual?
I think the issue is the difference between a statement that appears in a print regime, which by definition is going to be considered authoritative, versus a statement that appears on a website, which is not, which most people do not consider to be nearly as authoritative.
Well, now, as to authority, okay, I'll stop right there. Time's up, and I need to make my affirmative negative case. Well, now let's consider the distinction. I think the distinction that Mr. Cialdi laid down in his initial remarks is the crucial distinction. The distinction is between the internet regime and other regimes that allow tortious recovery for speech that ends up being treated as defamatory or invading privacy or subjecting someone to an intentional infliction of emotional distress, or alternatively a statutory regime that provides remedies for sexual harassment. Why should the internet be treated differently? If there's accountability in these other regimes, subject to the affirmative case being made, I mean, not all speech is subject to liability, it has to be tortious, has to be defamatory or invade privacy, subject someone to intentional infliction of emotional distress, and that includes an inquiry into whether there's a First Amendment privilege. So it's not as if all speech that hurts feelings is subject to liability. It has to meet the tests. It also has to meet, if we were analogizing to sexual harassment, it has to meet the tests for statutory liability. So the question is, why should the internet regime be exempt from all of this? Now, Mr. Cialdi, in his introduction, talked about free speech and how it's important to have, as he put it, a robust and uninhibited free speech. But consider the values that are often opposed, allegedly, to free speech in suits involving privacy and reputation. Can we say that these values are actually antithetical to free speech? Let's review the rationales for free speech. One rationale is autonomy, the idea that in speaking one is expressing oneself. Well, isn't protection for one's reputation or protection for one's privacy or freedom from harassment, isn't that part of one's identity and one's autonomy? How about the rationale that speech encourages self-governance, and therefore we should allow robust and unpleasant things to be said? Well, when we speak of self-governance, we typically think of self-governance in the political realm. Does that mean that private speech made about someone, calling someone attractive in an unpleasant way, referring to their physical attributes, making slurs on their name or reputation, is that what we call participating in democratic society, running for public office? I mean, isn't there a distinction between speech that directly has an effect on political life and speech that does not? Finally, the marketplace of ideas. The argument is, Mr. Scioli made it, the argument is that the best remedy for speech is more speech. Well, is that necessarily so? Suppose that something's been said about you, and you've been identified on one of these websites in a way that you should not want to be. You simply don't want people talking about you. You don't want people displaying your picture. You don't want people making salacious comments about you. Is the remedy for you to get on and complain about it and say this didn't happen to me or I object to it, thereby inviting other people to comment? To what extent is there a marketplace in ideas when one of the participants is an unwilling participant? So it doesn't seem to me that the values in privacy and reputation and protection from emotional distress are necessarily opposed to the values we want to protect in the First Amendment regime. All right, let me turn now to some suggestions. I think we could create, by analogy to the other regimes where defamation law and privacy law and intentional infliction of emotional distress exist, and also by analogy to the regime of sexual harassment, I think we could create a limited duty on the part of managers and owners of websites to moderate the content of those sites. I don't think that Section 230 bars that entirely, but I would also argue that Section 230 should be modified to include a provision that suggests there should be vigorous enforcement of federal discrimination laws. My idea would be to have liability, not vicarious liability, but direct liability, based on a negligence standard for website managers or owners who can be shown to have facilitated, not necessarily provided, but facilitated content on their websites. This would be in, it's already been suggested that 230 does not immunize all website providers, but only website providers that don't facilitate content as well as provide content. There's a Ninth Circuit en banc decision suggesting that. There are some other decisions, older decisions, with a more broad immunity for 230. But I think what happened since 1996, when Congress passed Section 230, is that we've shifted from a world in which there were these service providers, AOL and so on, that Congress wanted to make sure were not being unduly cautious in providing information, funneling information, because of the fear of lawsuits. We've now moved to a world where there are niche websites. AutoAdmit is an example of a niche website. AutoAdmit is not AOL. AutoAdmit is designed to a particular audience, law students and others who want to discuss law students and others. And it caters in part to audiences that are known to be very responsive to advertising. Well, is that the same as an AOL that's providing essentially a search engine that people can get funnel information from one place to another? So I think Congress had one model of the Internet in mind when it passed the Communications Act, the 1996 Act, and we now have a much more multifaceted model of what goes on in the internet. And the bald fact is that people on the internet, posters on the internet, anonymous posters on the internet, feel that they can create some kind of internet identity, almost always anonymous, that makes them a kind of avatar, a kind of person operating in a fantasy world where their internet persona can say anything fresh and uninhibited and whatever comes into, half-baked and whatever comes into their head. They would not be able to do this in the other regimes if that what was said was defamatory or invaded privacy or subjected someone to intentional infliction of emotional distress or constituted sexual or racial harassment. They would not be able to do that. There would be incentives not to do it. The incentives coming in the form of lawsuits and adverse publicity. But if you are an anonymous poster on a website, you don't have those incentives. It's time we created those incentives.
All right, Professor Weiss, if I understand you correctly, you're saying that AOL should have immunity under 230, but AutoMed should not.
No, I'm saying that if AutoMed can be said to have either provided or facilitated content, then it should not have immunity to the broad extent that AOL has under 230, yes. And I would also argue factually that AutoAdmit is doing just that. AutoAdmit is facilitating content.
What's your evidence of this?
The evidence is that any manager or owner of a website is aware of the content of messages that come in and sometimes deletes those messages.
Have you operated a website, Professor White?
I've not operated a website.
Message board?
I have no expertise.
Blog. Do you have a Facebook account?
No. Nope.
Twitter. MySpace.
I have no expertise in the technology of the internet whatsoever, and that in a sense makes me a better judge of what's going on. I'm not self-interested here.
All right. So what do you?
I'm not invested in the particular website. I don't make any money by criticizing or defending the position. So in some ways, I'm every person in this. Debate.
That's Professor White. So then I guess you'd agree that when trying to figure out the appropriate duty of care and medical malpractice, that doctors should have no say. Doctors are biased, and someone with no medical expertise whatsoever is the best person to do it?
Well, it's funny you should ask that. I teach a lot of medical malpractice. I've done a little of medical malpractice from the other side. The fact is, the way medical malpractice works, the doctors help set the standard of care, but the doctors have to adhere to the standard of care once set. The doctors don't get blanket immunity from committing malpractice. That is what the website providers get under 230. So the analogy fails.
Yeah, well, I'm prepared to go on to the next stage.
Okay, next stage is going to be the first affirmative rebuttal by Mr.
Seeley. Okay. Well, I'm really glad that Professor White touched on the issue of remedies, because that's one thing that I've noticed in a lot of these discussions. The issue of remedies tends not to get discussed, or just assume that a lawsuit is always going to be the best way to, just for a defamation victim to seek the redress that they seek. So I think we got some bit of time to spend on this. So I think we can all agree that defamation and similar torts are uniquely personal and are more likely to cause relative to other causes of actions an intense emotional reaction to a potential plaintiff. As Professor White said, sure, people don't like to be talked about online. I know I certainly don't. And I've had my share of things written about me online also that I didn't necessarily find flattering. And not surprisingly, empirical research strongly supports this proposition, with one study finding that, unlike other causes of action, a full 75% of defamation plaintiffs are not motivated by money, but file suit to get even with the defendant or try to correct the record. In fact, that same study concluded that the very act of filing a suit seemed to bring a feeling of victory to the plaintiff. And research by other scholars consistently found that, regardless of the outcome in the case, plaintiffs perceived themselves as winning simply by forcing the defendant to deal with the lawsuit. Empirical research and other aspects of defamation law further illustrates the extent of this problem. For instance, the Iowa Libel Research Project found that less than 10% of all defamation lawsuits result in a judgment in favor of the plaintiff, a percentage far lower than other personal injury lawsuits. In fact, studies have shown that although between 95 and 99% of all personal injury lawsuits settled before trial, only a mere 15 and 25% of defamation cases involve media defendants, which type of cases almost certainly to involve holding intermediary liable for third-party statements, result in a settlement, and most of the settlements involve no money changing hands. In fact, additional research has found that between 90 and 95% of all the money spent in the average defamation lawsuit is going to be attributed to the defendant's legal fees and expenses, the plaintiff incurring almost no costs. So you can see why it would be easy for a plaintiff to feel that he or she has won simply by filing suit, even if the end result is a judgment that's going to be in favor of the defendant. See, I would hope that we would all agree that litigants should not be permitted to abuse the legal system by using it as the mechanism to harass or punish innocent parties. Given our research demonstrates this is exactly what's happening when Section 230 immunity is not available to an intermediary, eliminating Section 230 and requiring an intermediary to screen user-generated content or otherwise imposing some sort of duty of care is not going to result in any legitimate gain to the plaintiff, but instead force intermediaries to choose between giving in to a heckler's veto and incurring substantial expenses. Accordingly, those concerned with the rights of defamation victims may wish to explore feasibility of private remedies that are likely to result in the type of vindication that most defamation plaintiffs seek. For instance, as Professor White mentioned, a lot of these websites are driven by advertisements, and one easy private remedy is to draw attention to the problem, state your case, and try to get the advertisers to no longer advertise there, try to get individuals not to post on their website anymore. So Troy called time, so a minute? Okay. All right, well, I'm just going to very quickly respond to Professor White's earlier statement regarding internet exceptionalism. I don't believe in internet exceptionalism. My personal belief here would be that if we are to, if Professor White's objection is that Section 230 somehow treats the internet differently relative to other media, it would seem the appropriate way to respond to that is, instead of killing the internet, grant that same immunity to other media as well. Thank you.
Professor White will make the negative report.
First, I just fail to see how the logic of suggesting that most people don't win defamation lawsuits, and most people are particularly concerned in defamation lawsuits with vindicating their reputation. I don't see how the logic of that cuts in the direction of giving up defamation lawsuits. In fact, one would think just the reverse, that given the odds that a plaintiff will be successful in a defamation lawsuit, you would think plaintiffs wouldn't proceed. Plaintiffs proceed because they're angry and outraged and unhappy that their reputation has been sullied. And they don't necessarily feel satisfaction just by bringing the suit. What they feel satisfaction is in calling the person or persons that have allegedly defamed them or invaded their privacy to account. But when we turn to sites like AutoAdmit, and I'm certainly not suggesting that the entire internet be scuttled. I think if certain websites that engage in consistently abusive behavior were shut down, I wouldn't think the world would be a worse off place. But I'm certainly not going after the entire internet. In any event, it just doesn't follow at all that because it's hard to win a defamation suit, people shouldn't be allowed to bring defamation suits in order to protect people who put up websites on the internet. And bear in mind all along that one of the cruxes of the problem, and it actually has an impact, adverse impact on Mr. Cioli, because Mr. Cioli's unnamed defendant. His identity is known. That's why he's sued, among other reasons, and that's why he's apparently been forced to sue people back. Because all the anonymous posters on AutoAdmit are operating under pseudonyms. They're not amenable to suit. So that is a very different situation from the non-internet world. Sure, there are anonymous pamphlets and there are anonymous conversations and so on, but on the whole, when one files a defamation suit or a privacy suit or an emotional distress suit or one sues for sexual harassment, there is a known person. There's a known defendant. Here we don't have known defendants. We have the, not only, we have double immunity. We have immunity for the service providers, and then we have immunity for the posters because the posters are anonymous. I just have one comment that goes beyond the law. What kind of social mores are we creating by this regime? It seems to me that we're encouraging people to sit in the privacy of their computer and say as mean and unpleasant and inappropriate things about other people with impunity. Because not only can they say them, no one knows who they are. And it is the perfect setting for juvenilia. It is the perfect setting for warped fantasists. And is the perfect setting for misogynists of various stripes. Do we want to create a generation of individuals growing up with these sorts of mores? It seems to me that's what we're encouraging with this kind of blanket immunity.
Thank you, Professor White. Mr. Scioli will make the affirmative rebuttal.
I'm going to keep this very brief since I know all of you are eager to start asking some questions. But just in response to Professor White's comments about the incentives caused by this whole regime, again, as many people have made it crystal clear with respect to the Audubon situation, you're not as anonymous as you think. There have been many lawsuits filed against anonymous speakers that have resulted in the anonymous speaker becoming unmasked and in many cases being forced to pay a judgment, which is actually what happened in the Audubon case with respect to several of these defendants. So I believe that there is no such thing as a double immunity. And just and even in the event that an individual just for some reason can't be unmasked, I don't think that's grounds for holding a third party, the intermediary, who didn't write the statement, likely had no knowledge of it beforehand, and in many cases probably isn't even in position to determine whether it is defamatory or not, to somehow hold that entity liable. I mean, look, personally, I love Sarah Palin, but I don't want her running the internet. I don't want her to have a heckler's veto. I don't want other people to have a heckler's veto in these sort of situations. We're essentially forcing an intermediary to take down content simply because someone might not like it. If those people didn't get the reference, there's a whole situation recently with Sarah Palin attempting to try to get some of these blog posts taken down. Glenn Beck has followed a similar action, I believe, relatively recently. And I think Congress got it right. I think that Congress is in a better position to make these determinations than law professors or the courts. And I'll leave it at that and hear what you guys have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Scioli, Professor White. I'd like to open it up. I'd like to join.